The recent terrorist attacks in Paris illustrate the ability of the so-called Islamic State to carry out orchestrated international attacks, attacks that cost money. According to the U.S. government, ISIS is probably the richest terrorist organization the world has ever known. For more on how the group has amassed such wealth, we turn now to Matthew Levitt, director of the Stein Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Matthew, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on the program.
So, Matt, ISIS first captured widespread attention in the U.S. last year when the group seized major Iraqi cities, including Mosul, and took control of extensive oil infrastructure in Iraq and Syria. So how much is in their coffers and how much money were they and are they bringing in every day?
We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, tremendous amount of money for a group that's not just a terrorist group but also a proto-state. At one point, the U.S. government was assessing that the Islamic State was bringing in around or just upwards of $3 million a day through the proceeds of oil sales alone. That was brought down, they believe, to about $1 million or a little under $1 million a day. It fluctuates, of course, because of circumstance, and now the estimate is between $40 to $50 million a month. But this is the second, not the first, primary resource for funding for them. The most important is taxation, or what we might call extortion, of the local population for every possible thing you can imagine.
Okay, so Matthew, tell us more about this thing of extortion and taxation. I mean, we would think of it as going door to door, hitting up businesses, forcing people to pay money to a government that is not a real government. And yet you say this is the biggest source of their income. How does it work?
It works by virtue of their controlling territory. They can tax everything from trucks on the road to people who want to open a business, to people who want to access their own bank accounts, to people who want to move from one place to another. Farmers, minorities, you name it, they can put a price on it, including putting a price on other ways of making money. So, for example, they've been making money based off of looting antiquities, but they're not doing all that digging themselves. They are actually, through a formal ministry, issuing permits for which there is a price, you might say a tax or an extortion, in order to be allowed to dig pits in this particular area.
So if you would rank the sources of the money that ISIS brings in, what are they?
In order, first of all, it is the extortion or taxation. Second is oil. And then come other types of criminal activity domestic to Iraq, antiquities, kidnapping for ransom, and every type of criminal activity you can imagine. And they're able to do it because they control such a large swath of territory.
Well, that brings us to a key point. It's because they have so much land that they can tax, you know, pull oil out of the ground, et cetera. And so the U.S. government has said that part of its campaign of airstrikes is very much about trying to deny them territory, deny them money. The U.S. has said that it has regained about 25% of the territory that ISIS had. How much of an effect has that had on their ability to bring in money or the total amount of funding that they control?
It's hard to say because there's not a lot of granularity in their day-to-day finances. But it is the case, and it's counterintuitive, that the best tool we have right now to deal with the Islamic State's primarily criminal enterprise fundraising is military tools. It's counterintuitive. You'd think it would be law enforcement, but we're not on the ground. Coalition forces aren't on the ground. The governments of Iraq and Syria are incapable. And so the tool that we're left with is pushing back on the area, amount of area they control. Remember that their motto is remain and expand. If we can prevent them from expanding and push back on the amount of territory they control, that's territory within which they cannot extort, they cannot make money off of the natural resources in that territory, whether it's oil or water or wheat or antiquities. And that's one of the primary tools we have at our disposal right now without ground forces going in.
Well, you've said that the group currently controls hundreds of millions of dollars. How much of that is going to pay fighters' salaries and provide services in the parts of Syria and Iraq that the group controls? And how much of it is going to finance overseas terrorist attacks?
The tiniest of fractions, if any, is going to finance foreign terrorist attacks. Frankly, the amount of money we're talking about, the low thousands, 20, 30,000 max, is money that if they wanted to, they could raise locally wherever they are in Europe or elsewhere through criminal activities. Hmm. That's the smallest thing. It's a nothing. Their biggest cost, of course, is salaries. Salaries of fighters, yes, but salaries of teachers. Salaries of people to pick up the garbage, just running society. And they are doing that. They've established ministries. They're very organized. It's very, very expensive. The Treasury Department reports that in just the parts of Iraq they control, the Iraqi government used to spend $2 billion a year, with a B, to run services in those areas. Let's even discount that by 50%, which is way too much. But let's say they're only providing half as much services. $1 billion a year is still a huge price tag.
All right. Well, you've said that oil is now only the second source of funding for them. How are they getting this oil and how are they getting it onto the market? Who's buying it, given that no doubt the U.S. and its allies are trying to target and prevent that kind of illicit oil from getting into the market?
Because the international community has been trying to cope with this, they've done several things. One thing they've done is try to increase the amount of oil, refined or not refined, that they use domestically for their own purposes. Second, they have a willing demand from the Assad regime, which is more than willing to buy Syrian oil from the Islamic State, knowing full well that this is financing the Islamic State. And then finally, because they are leveraging long pre-existing smuggling networks, rat lines, that have been functioning for many, many years, they didn't come into Mosul and suddenly become oil barons. They just plugged into an existing network of people who said, I don't care if Saddam controlled the oil or you control the oil. Just let me move it for you. Let me launder the proceeds for you. They're even, in a sense, laundering the oil itself. They mix it with other oils from other places. So you can't put a needle in there and tell that it came from a particular well, which otherwise you could have done.
Has the drop in global oil prices affected how much ISIS can raise?
Not really, because they were always selling well below market value. But now there are a series of things that are affecting them. First of all, there have been some oil fields themselves in the past few weeks have been targeted. There have been some refineries, not just the mobile refineries, that have been targeted. And that's a shift, because previously coalition forces didn't want to hit these very expensive targets in the hopes that maybe Iraq or Syria, a future government, would have them to be able to fund reconstruction. But clearly that's not going to happen anytime soon. And so people have gotten over that concern and are now targeting this infrastructure directly. Similarly, there used to be a concern in the past about targeting convoys of oil trucks either on the road or parked for fear of killing drivers who are mostly not Islamic State employees. They're just people who are hostage in Islamic State-controlled areas and are trying to make a living and put food on the tables. So reportedly, U.S. forces have been dropping leaflets saying, don't drive these trucks anymore. And we and others, according to some reports, including the Russians, have been targeting, strafing these convoys of trucks and putting them out of business.
Well, you've been studying terror finance for a long time, both in and out of government. Tell us, how does Islamic State compare to al-Qaeda or the Taliban? Do other groups have such diversified sources of income?
There are no groups that have had this diversified a source of income that were this large. This is certainly not the first group to make a lot of money out of taxation and extortion. Think of the FARC in Colombia, the Shabab in Somalia, the IRA. But never on this scale, never in control of this much territory, never with access to this amount of natural resources. And that does mean that some of the tools that we've traditionally used to target the financing of terrorism won't be as applicable for this target, the Islamic State. Insofar as they are raising money through criminal activities domestic in Iraq, our tools that are focused on monies crossing borders, moving through the international financial system, may not be as applicable, which is why the military has become such an important part here.
Well, in the few moments we have left, is there something that the international community is not doing that it should be doing to more effectively disrupt ISIS's sources of funding?
One of the things we're pushing hard for with our allies in the Gulf in particular is to better implement some of the laws they have. And I think we're seeing the beginning of a turning of a corner. There have been a series of arrests in Kuwait on terror finance for the Islamic State, for example, because they're seeing that the Islamic State is a true threat to them as much as it is to the West, as much as it is to fellow Sunnis in Iraq and in Syria. And I think that that's the most important thing we can do. We're seeing good cooperation between governments and the private sector. We're seeing how that information can feed activities all the way to the extreme of kinetic military action and certainly everything in between. But these are going to have to be intelligence-driven investigations. It's going to have to be a lot of intelligence sharing, and we're going to have to see more implementation on the ground, especially in these frontline countries.
Although the bad news is it sounds like you're saying that even if we deprive them of their hundreds of millions of dollars, that launching terrorist attacks overseas is actually relatively cheap in the tens of thousands of dollars.
That's true, and it's also true that they have enough money to last quite some time, but I will end on a high note, and that is I don't think the Islamic State has a sustainable financial model. You can only tax internally without open access to outside markets for so long. There's only so much resources. Almost everything they're doing is from non-renewable resources. If we had the luxury of time, I think the Islamic State would likely crumble on the weight of its own broken ideology and its lack of funding. We just don't have the luxury of waiting that out because they are completely ripping apart the region, fostering sectarian tension, carrying out terrorist attacks abroad, let alone the madness and terrorism that they're doing to fellow Arabs and Muslims in the region itself.
That's Matthew Levitt, a former Treasury Department official and director of the Stein Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Matthew, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.